Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Specht.
Hello.
What's happening, Derek?
Not much, man. Just waiting for the winter weather to hit.
Well, it was there for a little bit.
Yeah, it was
then
here.
It went away.
Then it was gone.
Then it was here. Then it's gone.
It was here.
Then it's pretending gone. To be here, then it's gone.
Yeah.
North of us and everything got hit, and south of us got hit. Apparently across New York State.
Yeah, yes, they did.
6 feet of snow or
they
something,
did.
Somebody said?
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of videos lately of the severe weather in the States, and there, unfortunately, people are, you know, dying, and so it's the storms are pretty bad. Highways are very treacherous. I know. And so there is that band across South Central.
across Ajax and Bowmanville.
No, there's the band through Bracebridge and...
they get hit too.
Yeah, twice they've gotten hit with like 100 plus centimeter snowfalls. It's just that little band.
I hate not having snow, but having it below freezing. If it's going to be minus whatever...
I want snow.
Then dump some snow. Be done with it.
Yeah.
None of this crap.
Yeah.
Give us winter or not. Give us winter or give us, like, beach weather.
Exactly.
One of the two. Make up your mind. Anyway.
Oh, what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Tired this week. It's been a long week, and it's only Tuesday.
Yep.
Oh,
it's good though. Like I'm thinking, I keep thinking of all the stuff going forward. Like we're starting to plan our winter trips. We've narrowed it down to a few areas where we think we might be going for winter camping. I'm not going to join the boys this year. It's family day. I'm going to spend the holiday with my family. So,
families are overrated.
So I'm going to do that. I haven't told the boys yet, but Mike will hear this and he'll find out that I'm not going.
Oh, just call him up. I have a cold coming on.
No, he's gonna hear the recording.
You sound bad, Derek. Start coughing.
Yeah.
That's Derek.
I'm going to be sick for family day.
We're just getting our notice in early.
Yeah.
A month and some early.
Exactly.
But yes. I had this cough for a month and a half.
Exactly. So that's exciting. We're planning that. I'm thinking of all the... We're going to do some of these outdoor spring shows and stuff, or winter shows. So
spring. Spring has sprung.
So
well, one
excited.
Of them is January. We'll talk about that later. But
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm getting excited. Things are starting to happen. Things are starting to move. We're in the new year. So, yeah. So regardless of all the other stuff that's going on, I'm looking forward to getting out into the outdoors.
I just wish it would warm up. Like I say, I don't like cold weather if there's no snow to go with it. You can't go out and do winter activities if there's no snow.
My work
can't build a snowman in minus 15.
My work and some of the windows at work, the whole wall of windows face the Lake Ontario. And I love it when it's cold and windy because everything, all the chain link fences along the edge of the property get covered in snow. And there's a big pile of snow that forms in one of the bays. And it's just like, wow, this is amazing. So it's
and there's Derek and his buddies running out to the chain link fence, daring each other to stick their tongue on it.
Stick your tongue on the fence. Stick your tongue on the fence.
Derek's gonna do it.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so that's exciting. I spend a lot of time staring at windows, at least 8 hours a day.
And the rest of the time licking them.
Yeah.
Do you ever stick your tongue on a metal pole or anything when you were a kid?
I did as a kid. Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I have done that. And it wasn't good. I remember for days afterwards, like any hot foods or soups, it's like, it burns. Yeah. No sympathy for mom and dad.
Of course not. Why would there be?
Yeah.
It's part of growing up. You have to do it. If you haven't done it,
so
go outside right now.
Find
a fence. Or pull.
I lost skin off of, it was separate occasions. It's not like I did it once and learned my lesson.
Why would you?
So I lost skin off my tongue a couple times, and I lost skin off my lips one time.
The first time I ever met Mark in the park.
Oh, yeah?
Was at the Wolf Den.
Oh,
yes. It was winter.
Yeah.
And we were going to meet up, and we're going to do a couple of
the
hiking trails.
Yeah.
And they got a big fire outside at night. So we grabbed all our drinks, and we bundled up, and we went and stood around the fire. enjoying the warmth of the fire while sipping our drinks.
Yeah.
Doofus here totally forgot he had a metal cup.
Oh, no.
I was drinking from a metal, not even giving it a fuck. It's my camp cup.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I put up, oh, crap.
Oh, crap. Go, go. We're back.
Yeah, my lip stuck to my cup. But, hey, prove that's my cup. That's my lip.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, just like with jellyfish, there's a way to get yourself melted off that.
No, yeah, just rip it off. It's like a Band-Aid,
just
baby.
Like, just like you do with jellyfish.
Nope, just like a Band-Aid.
Just like jellyfish.
Just like a Band-Aid. Rip that sucker right off. Only hurt for a minute.
Wouldn't hurt at all. Go to the jellyfish way.
Yeah. Your aim sucks, buddy. Oh, man. Anyway. But everybody's talking about the Monday morning blues and February. What is it? Not the February blues. What's the February?
There's cabin fever. There's SAD, seasonal affective disorder. Is that sort of where you're?
Yeah. What's the February one?
I have no idea.
It's not cabin fever. It's not the winter. Yeah, it's February is when it happens, when everybody just starts to...
The winter doldrums, the winter blues, the winter... I don't know.
Anyway.
Sad. Seasonal affective disorder.
If you want to escape these Monday morning blues,
mm-hmm.
and you're over in Suffolk...
It's summer in Australia right now.
Right? Bet you they don't have to deal with frozen cups on there. No, but they got to worry about jellyfishes.
Yes.
Can't try to rip that sucker off.
Yeah.
Pick up a paddle and get on the river. This is the advice of Suffolk paddling enthusiast Neil Boast.
There you go.
Over in England. According to British Canoeing, all forms of paddling in boats, canoeing, kayaking, and stand-up paddleboarding have enjoyed dramatic growth in recent years, and Suffolk rivers are no exception. Take yourself down to the Deben any weekend in summer, and you're likely to spot paddle traffic ranging from lone kayaker heading downriver, perhaps for a pint, at Waldringfield or Ramsholt, before coming back with the tide to a flotilla of paddleboard starters being shepherded along safe waters by an instructor like so many ducklings. So you got Mama Duck and all the little ducklings following, but they're all paddleboarders. So you hop in your kayak, you head down the river, grab a pint, and then you ride the tide back. How come we don't get stuff like that here? I feel ripped off all of a sudden.
Suffolk is on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm. Interest in paddling has exploded since the lockdown, says Neil, a retired policeman who has been kayaking since the age of 12. I've paddled so many different rivers, but for me, Suffolk is the best place in the world. Either by luck or design, Neil lives within a few kayak-carrying steps of the Drebbit. Yeah, because I wouldn't want to be portaging a kayak more than a few steps. His garden is a parking lot for all types of kayaks and paddleboards, and he has become a go-to local person for tips on how to get on the river paddling and how to stay safe and enthusiastic thereafter, which is important. To help all who want to get on the water and keep finding new excitement in paddling, Neil runs a River Driven Paddlers Facebook page, which contains advice on everything from tides and wildlife. Look out for the seals and egrets if you're lying low in your kayak, and listen out for the lapwings and noisy oyster catchers. To the best access points and places like Honolulu Beach, yes, a beach by the river, which can make a great target destination if you're looking for a short upriver paddle from Woodbridge. We've got members from all over the country and abroad, he says. If you join a group and share information, you're going to find out everything you need to know about the river. His advice to complete beginner is also to join a local canoe club and get some basic instruction. Well, that's like the Durham Region Kayakers group that we have here.
Yeah.
Like, if you go on that Facebook group, like, people are always talking about different rivers and routes and stuff in the area to paddle. And if you have any questions, you can throw it out there. And there's a bunch of people that'll, oh, you want to launch from here? Or if you're only one here, you can launch from here, do a turnaround point. This is a great half day, full day, paddle, that sort of stuff. Very helpful. Heading downriver, working hard against wind and tide before turning right to explore Martlesham Creek, Neil boasts it's the perfect kayak buddy, telling stories about the river, pointing things out along the way, and giving insights into his own passion for paddling. My older brother David made me my first kayak during his lunch breaks and gave it to me for my birthday. During his lunch breaks. I was already a keen swimmer, and as soon as I got on the water, I was hooked. My wife says I must have been an otter in a former life. Knowing how to swim, he says, is a must for anyone getting on the water in this way. Neil, who was brought up in Stowmarket, swam for the county, another reason why he oozes confidence on the water. And more often than not, he will use paddling as a good reason to moor up somewhere nice for a dip. So that's the other thing a lot of people do. They'll paddle up somewhere, find a beach,
yeah,
go for a swim, lunch, relax, maybe a snooze, and then paddle back.
And I'm looking at Suffolk area. There's a lot of beaches, a lot of waterways,
mm-hmm.
a lot of parks. Like, there's a lot of parks on the east coast of it's. Yeah, there's a lot of names I recognize from movies like Ipswich, and it's a nice area.
Yeah, you should go. Where do you take it now?
Wish I could.
Becky McInnes Clark of Nomad Sea Kayaking agrees that knowing how to swim and safety generally should be a key priority for more paddlers. While there has been a huge growth in paddlers on the water, there are so many people who refuse to wear any form of safety device or even the basic essential buoyancy aid. Last year, there was 155% raise paddleboard incidents over the previous years.
Incidents or
incidents.
Injuries and deaths?
Incidents.
Just incidents.
Yeah, she just says incidents. People don't realize that you can get a buoyancy aid for as little as 30 pounds. From one of the supermarkets. Yeah, life jackets aren't that expensive.
Yeah, no, they're it's of such a price that it makes no sense not to buy yourself one.
Right. Company does its best to keep paddlers safe, offering a mixture of short courses and trips along the coast and up local rivers, with wild camping thrown in as an option. It's funny to hear that, like, the wild camping.
Mm-hmm.
And we just take that for granted.
Yeah.
Over here, right? It is so important to get even the basic training, says Becky. Many people are getting blown offshore at Felixstowe, which means the volunteer lifeboat has to come and rescue them. Number of emergency calls out for paddlers are rising, and so are the number of lives being lost. And that's true, because when we're Googling for different topics to talk about or following different Google trails, the amount of incidents and deaths and being blown offshore. Emergency life boats having to be sent out to get people that have been blown up to sea.
Rip
and
tides,
stuff like
undertows,
that. Yeah,
just heavy winds,
non-stop.
Mm-hmm.
Lockdown restrictions in overseas travel help fuel the paddler boom, and British Canoeing reports a 127% increase in membership since 2020.
Wow.
According to the Water Sports Participation Survey in 2021, a whopping 7.6 million people across the UK said they had either kayaked, used a canoe, or a stand-up paddleboard. During the lockdowns, more people than ever discovered the fun and enjoyment of paddling, says Chris Earle, Director of Recreational Paddling at British Canoeing. That's a lot of people. Big percent, 127% increase since 2020.
Yeah, so, and the population is 68 million people in the UK.
That's not too shabs.
Mm-hmm.
The new kid on the block and the fastest growing of all paddling options is undoubtedly stand-up paddleboarding, which can be described as rather cool and convenient, especially if you buy a starter inflatable board, which can be launched at any safe and accessible place along the river. It caters for a whole spectrum of people who don't just want to sit down all the time, says Ricky Burrows, an open water leader and instructor with East Coast Adventure. You can stand, sit, or kneel on your board. They are really versatile, and in terms of entry price, you can buy what you can afford. which is true.
Yeah.
Right?
And it's...
I mean, it's nice to have the top-notch, great, lightweight, sturdy board, but...
There's at the Quiet Adventures Symposium, there's those guys in the ring part of it,
mm-hmm.
where they had hand-built wooden stand-up paddle boards.
Oh, yeah, those.
And those were beautiful. Like $3,000-$5,000.
Yeah. I don't need one of those.
They were very nice, though.
Oh,
very impressive.
That's one of those things you just want to put in your living room when people come over.
Yeah, hanging on the wall. Look at this.
Yeah. Oh, do you use that? Never.
Never. I don't dare get it wet.
I think I would rather scratch a brand new canoe before I scratched something like that.
Yes. Yeah.
Like,
you just wouldn't feel good about it. It's like, well, the ones that I remember seeing there at the show, they were like artwork.
Yeah.
Like the detail and the hand details. It's like, it was impressive.
Yeah. It caters for, that, like I say, the whole spectrum of people that just don't want to sit down in a canoe or a kayak. One distinction, arguably, is between novices and fun paddlers and the more hardcore variety, the likes of Neil Boast, who paddle boards for family fun but also has a passion for kayak racing. Neil has completed the 164-mile Devizes to Westminster event, which he describes as the Everest of kayak racing. Taking on the Thames, aside from the sheer race exhaustion, means big tankers and all manner of commercial traffic. And it's up to you to keep out of their way, as they just won't see you in a kayak.
They don't have the capability to maneuver around you.
Ah, kayak versus an oil tanker. What could possibly go wrong? Same applies to a lesser extent on the River Orwell. And if you get anywhere near the mouth, you should really have a radio, says Neil. That's why I'm finding a lot of the guys that I'm paddling with on Lake Ontario.
UHF radios?
They've all got the UHF radios. Yeah.
I thought about getting myself one.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to get myself a pair of them. Because if you're going with somebody.
Got walkie-talkies.
You could do that. Yeah, and I do have a set of walkie-talkies. Yeah. We use them for stuff like
but
that.
But no, they're using this in case something goes wrong.
So, with the UHF one, it's a marine radio. It's like, you know, whatever channel, I think 16 is. But you get also like radio weather reports and mm-hmm. stuff. And so it's very handy. I had a use of a friend's sailboat, and he had a couple of them on board. They were very handy. So
I've never owned one, but I've thought if I'm mm-hmm. going to do more lake stuff.
Yeah.
I really
it
should.
Would be smart to do.
If I've got the spot unit in case, then having that one in case as well, right?
But it's just the simplicity or the ease of having a method of communication if something goes wrong, so that you don't have to hit a spot or you don't have to call up major rescue. You can just say, hey, I have this issue and mm-hmm. Keep monitoring me or
whatever. Oh, and
whatever.
We've got issues, buddy.
Yes, we do. Undiagnosed and diagnosed.
So the advice is don't go anywhere near the mouth of the river until you've got the right gear and you know exactly what you're doing. The race itself, he says, is about pushing yourself farther than you ever think you can go. This is why a lot of special forces take part and uses a test of endurance and mental toughness. Having to pee in your pants over a 30-hour period is not for the faint-hearted.
Yeah, it feels good
at first. Wait, you mean everybody doesn't do that?
It feels good at first, but then it gets cold.
It's this nice, warm feeling inside. Nor is crossing the North Sea in a kayak, a feat achieved by 32 Dutchmen in September 1941 and commemorated by a rather poignant memorial at Sizewell Gap near the nuclear power station. These brave chaps succeeded in escaping Nazi-occupied Holland to join Allied forces, but only three survived the war. The words on one of the kayak oars tells us that the last living survivor dedicates this memorial to his brothers-in-arms who were less fortunate.
Hmm.
As for Suffolk, Neil says it's the best assets is its rivers. The Deben, certainly, but also the Oar and the Auld, the Stour, and indeed the Orwell. So if you're going over to Suffolk, doesn't seem like you're going to be hard-pressed to find somewhere to go paddling. Because
mm-hmm.
it's on the rise. That's like, 127% increase. That's huge. 7.6 million people across the UK said they've either kayaked, canoed, or stand-up paddleboarded. Pretty good.
It is, yeah.
Just another place to add on the to-do list.
Oh, I just found Nottingham.
Uh-oh.
Nottingham, Birmingham.
Isn't that Robin Hood?
Stonehenge.
I think you're a little bit farther away, are you not? Are you going the right direction?
Oh, I went...
Are you going inland?
I'm looking west.
Yeah.
From...
right now, Derek's kayaking across the country. here's one for you. Khalid Hufishi.
Whoa.
Has temporarily banned the use of canoes in their mangroves so as not to disturb the migratory flamingos
roosting
there at this time. Since 2022, flamingos have been visiting the Maldives during migration around this time each year. This year, their first destination is the mangroves of Khalid Hufishi.
Did you look up the pronunciation?
I looked up that pronunciation and did it phonetically because K-U-L-H-U-D-H-U-N-F-U-S-H-I. Wow. You think I'm going to remember that?
Oh, no.
Am I going to get that first go?
It looks like whoever wrote this misspelled it. So this is in the Maldives.
Yeah. The announcement, the council says that they are receiving complaints that some in canoes are venturing too close to the flamingos. And the way they spell flamingos.
Yeah,
Is that correct or not?
I didn't know that there was an E at the end.
I didn't think there was an E. Flamingos. Where is he going? And acted in ways that would disturb the birds. Due to this, the council has decided to temporarily ban the use of canoes in the mangroves. Council urged the public to report any incidences of canoe and otherwise causing disturbance to the birds. Each day, many residents of the island visit the mangroves to shoot photos of the visiting birds, which are widely shared on social media, which brings in more tourists.
Yeah, exactly.
Which we've discussed before.
Yeah. So if people would just stop doing that.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know what? Like, just because they're there,
mm-hmm.
take a look at the photos. You don't have to mm-hmm. go and disturb. But that's like in Australia and stuff like that. They cordon off areas where the turtles are coming up and nesting.
Yeah.
And there's other areas that, like with the manatees and stuff like that, you can't go there at certain times. You can't be paddling with them.
And there's areas that they do try and limit traffic, but people mm-hmm. still go through, like, was it Christmas Island with the red crabs? Where it's like the ground's completely blanketed with these crabs migrating across the island. And so there's a lot of areas like that. It's I know in New Brunswick there's an area where there's a massive frog migration that you have to be careful because you can slip across the road because you're running over
so many frogs. That just north here.
Yeah.
Like going up towards Muskoka and stuff, mm-hmm. you'll be sitting on the back roads and then you'll be seeing, like, at night in the evenings.
Yeah.
You got your headlamps on it, and you're just...
Why is the
heck is all of it? It's all these frogs crossing the road.
Yeah.
Weird.
So, flamingo in North America is spelled with I-N-G-O, but here in the Maldives, they spell it with an I-N-G-O-E.
B-I-N-G-O-E.
E.
Yeah. So, if you're in the Maldives, and you're near Khalid Hufishi, stay away from the mangroves at this time.
Is it Maldives or Maldives? I don't know.
I've always called it Maldives.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard it both ways, but I've always heard it did the Maldives option. You got an option.
Yeah. Sometimes it's good that we don't get too much feedback on the show.
Oh, dude. Like, I mean, wait till this next one. Wait till the next one, buddy. You had to open your mouth, didn't you?
A hungry. Something about a hungry man?
Hungry. Yeah.
He's hungry.
So we know Cyril Deramo.
Oh, yes.
He's kayaking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he's got his big, funky
At an update of his travels?
Yeah, he's cruising along. So he's still going.
I haven't looked since he started off.
No, he's going. So he's got the, you know, it's like he's sitting in the middle of this big kayak. It's got two cabins sort of thing, one for storage, one for, like, sleeping communications and all that sort of stuff. So on December 23rd, Gabor Rakonski Rakonczay. He's a Hungarian fella. Started paddling from La Palma in the Canary Islands. The Hungarian adventurer is hoping to canoe 5,000 kilometers across the Atlantic Ocean to Antigua. He originally scheduled to leave on December 16th, but difficult weather delayed him several times. He's doing pretty much the exact same thing, but he's starting farther north, as Cyril is.
So where's Cyril from? I can't remember.
The island south of there.
Okay, so...
The Canary Islands, right?
So,
or no, he's ending in the Canary Islands.
La Palma is off Western Sahara,
yeah,
near Tenerife.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember where he took off from. Cabo Verde? Anyways.
So, he's doing...
That's a long distance. That's a lot of open water.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do it.
No.
He is... Cyril... You've got me thinking different things now.
Yeah.
Cyril is using his kayak.
Mm-hmm.
But Gabor is using a canoe.
So, is it a canoe or is it...
Well, that's the thing. Is Cyril really in a kayak?
That's true, too.
Right? So, picture Cyril's...
So, I guess really it's the style of paddling.
Well, he's not rowing. He's canoeing. So, it's long and built like Cyril's, except the cabin is all up front and he's at the back and he's using a single blade.
Yeah.
As opposed to Cyril, who's in the middle and using a double blade.
So can this guy see where he's going? I guess you don't really need to see where you're going when you're in the middle of nowhere and there's nothing to hit.
Yeah, he can see. Unlike most current Atlantic crossings, he's canoeing. In the past 18 years, and that's why I said most current Atlantic crossing. How many people are crossing the Atlantic right now?
Well, two that we know of right now.
Now? Yeah. I didn't know this was a thing this year. He has completed several ocean expeditions. Back in 2007, he became the first Hungarian to row across the Atlantic. 2012, he was the first person to make a transatlantic crossing by canoe. Note that this canoe resembles the sort of custom seagoing kayak used by ocean crossers like Cyril Deramo.
Mm-hmm.
With lots of storage and a cockpit for sleeping, but he uses a single-bladed paddle, hence canoe.
Well, I found his website.
Gabor has tried to cross Atlantic on a stand-up paddleboard twice, and both ended in disaster. The first time, he had to turn back because of the damage to the craft. On the second, he had to be rescued after he had been began hallucinating from sleep deprivation.
Yeah, well...
I wouldn't want to be on a stand-up paddleboard.
No, there's no shelter, there's no...
Nothing!
You're basically...
You're Tom Hanks in...
You're Rose on a floating door after the Titanic sunk.
Right?
Why stand up paddleboard? That makes no sense.
This is the fifth ocean boat he's designed and built. He says, I've condensed it into a new ship in the 15,400 kilometers of experience I have so far. The result is a 170-kilogram, 7-meter-long vessel with 16 open and 6 closed compartments, a cabin, epoxy glass laminate, and a closed-cell foam sandwich structure. He named the canoe 42 after the age he was when he decided to undertake this last adventure. He is 43 now. Rockensay hopes to complete the crossing in 65 days. However, experience has shown him that expeditions rarely go according to plan when crossing an ocean. For that reason, he has packed enough food for 80 days. And I think Cyril was estimating 80 days.
Yeah.
And he's going a bit less than this.
Because of 92 or 95.
Well, that was the other way.
Get to Hawaii.
Yeah.
He wants to do this one quicker and...
Though the crossing started a week ago, well, more than that now, project has been underway for some time. Most ship their boat to the start line instead. He did a test run in December 2023 by paddling 1,400 kilometers from Portugal to the Canary Islands. He thought the crossing would take 16 to 20 days. It took a month because of the complete lack of wind and excess shipping traffic. The closure of the Suez Canal meant the cargo ships went through the Gibraltar. Because of this, I had 8 to 10 cargo ships around me at all times. Navigation was like a game of chess. Could you imagine that? You're in this little tiny thing and these massive tankers are zipping by.
Oh, yeah. Like, and they're not looking out for you. You have to watch out for them because they won't even see you. They don't even know you're there.
Even if they did see you and went past you, the waves they're putting out.
Yeah, in the grand scheme of things, with how rough the oceans are, like, you probably wouldn't even notice.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. Hmm. Like, they do plow through, but it dissipates pretty quick.
I would think he would still get...
I've been to sea.
Billy.
I've been to sea, Billy.
His boat then sat in storage in La Palma on the Canary Islands, ready to begin the ocean crossing. During his first 4 days in the water, he covered 254 kilometers. The initial few days were not easy. Waves crashed around him, rain poured, and lightning struck nearby every few minutes. This is the exact same thing we were reading on Cyril's blog that he has next to his tracking.
Yeah.
Conditions are now more manageable. So if you want to follow Gabor, my.yb.tl/42.
So that's a new website. So I found his old one, which is hislastname.com.
Yeah, is that a tracker, though?
No, it's not a tracker.
No, this is a tracker like Cyril's.
The one that I found is all of his previous expeditions.
Oh,
so
yeah.
He did this same, sort of the same trip back in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the rowing one.
That was the solo transatlantic canoing.
Oh, right, 2012. 2007 was
doubles,
the rowing one.
Doubles rowing was...
2007.
Yeah, 2007. This is pretty much all he's done in his life is
right?
Trips like this.
What the heck?
Professionally unemployed. I sound like I'm talking down. I couldn't do what he's doing.
No.
I really couldn't. But
the only thing I always have about this is, like, it's cool to do this. And, like, I would love to do it too. But then you just get the reality.
Yeah.
The reality brain of a regular
You'd
Joe.
Have to be
what
really
happens when you retire? Time to retire.
Yeah.
You got no nest egg.
You would
no
hope that
no
he's,
home, no...
You'd hope he's embezzling from himself to put some money away for the future.
Hey, Gabor, look the other way. Why? Because I'm stealing from me. Yeah, like that'd be my only thing is no pension, no nothing at the end of the day.
So
but you've lived your life.
And if you are, like, once you get too old to trip and travel, I imagine you can do some speaking tours.
Well, he does do this,
so,
just like Cyril does.
Yeah, and so Explorers Club and stuff like this, where you discuss and talk about and question and answer periods and stuff like that, where they pay you to be there. But it's not that lucrative. It's not like you're an ex-president and making a couple million.
No, but
a year.
I know, like, Cyril, he'll visit schools and do talks and community groups and
but you're
all
not
that
making
sort of
much money from that.
No, but you've got to definitely be stacking the way in your sock drawer.
Yeah, you
got to
do something, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so I had Cyril's map up and Gabor's map up, and that'd be awesome if they met, because realistically, there's a chance. If one corrects the other way and one...
Yeah, exactly.
Like, one turns just south and one turns just north.
They're going to...
Eventually, they're going to meet.
Yeah, and then it's our own race.
Then there's going to be a fight, a big paddle fight. Anyway, yeah, you can find my.yb.tl/42 if you want to see his route to the same niche destination.
Same-ish. Yeah.
Ish. Kind of cool, though. This one. I know we were talking about this earlier.
Yes.
Dun, 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 dun.
I don't usually read ahead much, but this one I found interesting. So
you don't read at all. What are you talking? Don't try to fool these people. They're onto you. They've been listening for 464 shows. They know you don't read more than comic books.
Hey, what are they called?
They're not dolls.
Graphic novels.
Yeah, they're graphic novels.
Graphic novels.
Right. Right. And they're not dolls. They're...
Huh?
When people, that's a doll. That's not a doll. It's an action figure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And graphic novels. Yeah. Right. Anyway, you don't usually read ahead.
No.
But.
But I did this time.
I came across this one because it's actually, there's some science-y stuff in here and some travel-y stuff and some eating stuff. And yeah, I figured you would really kick into the science side of this.
Mm-hmm. My eyes didn't glaze over when I read this one.
There was no donuts involved.
Nope.
So, you know, but still. For a period of 2 months last year, a typical day for Chef Mike Keane would have seen him skipping breakfast and lunch in favor of snacks such as dried
capelin.
Yeah, apparently it can be pronounced both, another word that pronounced both ways.
In the Maritimes, we call them capelins.
Yeah, well, you're not in the Maritimes now, pal.
Okay, fine.
You're in the middle of the country. Capelin, small bait fish, dried halibut, jerky-like dried whale, and a local Greenlandic whale skin and blubber treat called matak. Evenings, he would dine on seal or whale stew, essentially just boiled meat in water, while camping on rocky islands. He might also add seabirds, eggs, and perhaps fish, walrus, reindeer, fish roe, or crowberries if he found them. He swapped his usual coffee for water or tea made with foraged herbs. All this while kayaking almost the distance of a marathon every day through a particularly cold spring in Greenland. So what was Keane up to? It started with a challenge raised over a beer with a Greenlandic chef. All good stories start with a challenge over a beer. What if you kayaked from the country's most southerly town to the most northerly? Keane had regularly worked in Greenland as a chef in a luxury camps along its jagged fjords, and he liked the sound of a 3,000-kilometer, 1,850-mile adventure. I thought, if I did 30 kilometers a day, that's 100 days.
There you go.
It's probably doable, and then I thought it might be interesting to include a scientific study.
Keep the mind active. I'm not just going to mind-numbly paddle. I'm going to, like, do some work.
When Wes Hansen was doing the Northwest Passage, were they not collecting water samples as they went?
That was the first year. That was the plan. And they're also going to visit a bunch of historical sites.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that went away for... We haven't closed loop on his second trip.
No, we need yet. To.
We had never talked to him about it.
Yeah.
Well, briefly we have, but no details.
Yeah. He decided to explore the effects of an Inuit diet on health and well-being, working with the Department of Twin Research and Genetic Epidemiology at King's College London. In Greenland and a few other pockets in the world, there are people connected to the environment living a hunter-gatherer community. They're still living off the land and the environment. I wanted to try that. Keane kayaked the west coast of Greenland in 2023 following a strict ancestral Inuit diet, and then completed a second expedition in 2024, spending 60 days in the eastern Greenland eating the same diet but without the exercise to compare results. I'm thinking that's just 2 years to get out of work.
That's just
I'm gonna do some science here.
Spring break.
Yeah, you got a grant for it, I bet.
But if you think about it, like, his normal job is to go to these camps and mm-hmm. cook for people. And so you would there that would be a seasonal work.
Yeah.
So there would be off-season type of stuff where you could do something like this.
Do something like this,
right?
The trek was far from the usual luxurious foodie adventure that might normally tempt a chef. Climate change has made the seasons in Greenland unpredictable, he says. I went in spring, but temperatures were more like winter at minus 12 Celsius. Sometimes the sea was iced over and I would have to break the ice in front of the kayak, each kilometer taking an hour.
Gee, so
never done that in front of the canoe before.
No, but think about this. So he's in seawater.
Mm-hmm.
Seawater is a bit harder to freeze. And so you're talking like in open bays, calm water, obviously the rest of the ice wouldn't form. So it's like it's cold enough that seawater is forming ice in front of him.
And how much is that drifting in too?
Exactly, right?
At one point, he was stuck in a storm for 3 days and three nights, and the wind picked up his kayak and threw it with such force at his tent that the main pole broke and cut his face.
That's not something you normally prepare for.
Right? What happened? My kayak jumped me in the middle of the night. It brought home to Keene how close to the edge life in Greenland can be. When he finally made it to Nuuk, he got another shock. I thought I'd lose some weight because of the exercise, he says, but when I got to Nuuk about 4 weeks in, I was really shocked at how much I had lost. Keene had access to scales for the first time and found that his weight had dropped about 90 kilograms, from 90 kilograms, which is 198 pounds, to 75 kilograms to 165 pounds. So basically, he lost just over 30 pounds.
Yeah, 31.
He thought, actually, that's not too fast.
Yeah.
And if I keep going at this rate, at some point, I'm going to keel over in the kayak and drown. Which, yeah, I mean, you keep going and going and going. You're eventually on that diet.
Yeah.
However, Keene's weight loss leveled out, and he completed his journey. In pre- and post-trip tests, looking at everything from lung function to blood pressure and grip strength, the results were striking. We saw a dramatic improvement in virtually all his health parameters, says Dr. Tim Spector, professor of epidemiology at King's College London. I wasn't surprised they improved, but I was surprised at how dramatically they improved. In both trips, Keene lost a significant amount of weight, 27 pounds or 12.4 kilograms on the first trip and 14.3 kilograms or 31 pounds on the second. And his blood pressure reduced significantly. His grip strength improved, his lung function improved, and his body fat dropped from 26.8 to 17.4%.
17.4 is still high. That's, you're not too low.
You're still right? Getting a lot leaner than...
Because they say, what, us typical swimmers, body fat is about 8 to 12%. Yeah. So, which is pretty low.
But, I mean, going from almost 27 to 17.5.
Yeah. That's a big difference.
That's a big jump. Yeah. What's interesting to see is that he was following the exact opposite of zero-fat diet. And it had this incredibly beneficial effect. And I'm going to use this when Tracy says I'm eating too much fatty stuff.
No, it's a keto diet. It's keto.
It's the Inuit diet.
it's proven. It's centuries right? proven.
His fat intake must have quadrupled. His protein intake probably doubled. And his massively reduced carbohydrates.
No bread.
He was on something close to a ketogenic, low-carb, high-fat diet, which most people can't support long-term. The experience has changed how Keene looks at food. There are only a few people who are still hunter-gatherers left in places like Greenland and the Amazon. They're the only ones that still have that connection to the environment and landscape. It's kicked me off on a journey to explore an Eat Your Environment mission. This mission involves looking critically at the global food system and seeking out ways to reconnect with the regions where people are still eating food untouched by it. Now, we talked about a little bit about this earlier and how the foods they ate and the life expectancy back in the day, we were looking in mid-1800s.
We did a little bit of unofficial, we did Facebook research type thing, but not Facebook, but you know what I mean. So we looked a little bit into it, and it's one of those things I've always wondered is like, how do you survive? Like, if you are up north, like I'm used to, hey, you got to have vegetables with every meal. You got to starch, you got to protein. And so it's a well-balanced
Canada's
diet.
Food
it's
guide.
Canada's food guide, all the different food groups. You had to eat properly and have the right nutritional intake. And if you don't have it, you need to take supplemental vitamins and so on. And I thought to myself, I have thought about this in the past. I've just never put any effort into it. Researching it.
I've been researching the donut diet for ages.
Exactly. So anyways, I often wondered, like, how did the Inuit back in the day, how did they survive long-term, like generational survival you're eating
mostly
elk and you're mostly proteins and fats, right?
Yeah.
So it only in like mid to late summer when there's enough snow melted and some of the wild berries and grasses start breaking through, would you have any roughage? Right. Mm-hmm. So you might be able to make a few teas, and if you collect enough, have teas to last out part of the winter. You wouldn't be able to save any berries because they would rot by winter. So you'd have eat as many berries as you can in the summer. And so how did they, what kind of lifespans? So what did we find out?
Then you get stuff like pemmican and stuff like that, right? Where you could grind it all up, melt it into these.
Yes. These bricks. So, yeah. And pemmican was typically, so the natives did teach some of the early voyagers, this is how you prepare food that will store and last. And and so you could have hidden food cairns and caches so that if hunter-gatherers were traveling a certain distance over the ice floes and stuff and on islands and high points, you'd have a rock mound that you'd bury pemmican in type thing, right? But pemmican was really traditionally like a settler voyager type.
A bit farther food. South.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A bit further south.
But you got to think that the Inuit probably had something.
Well, they would cut up into strips and dry on sticks in the sun, like whale fat and whale skin and so on. So it would lose most of its weight and moisture, but it still had a lot of the food quality, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, well, how do you survive on a diet like that? And obviously, back in the day, like today's different. You can get a lot of modern foods and proteins and starches,
and vitamins and
stuff to help. You know, what was it? We discovered that typical lifespan of Inuit these days is 82 or something. Yeah.
Then it was back in the 50s. It was like 68, but back in the mid 1800s,
yeah,
was like 30 to 35.
Yes,
which was 10. Years younger than anywhere else in Canada.
Yeah, so if you're southern and where you'd have proper, typically, life, you know what, life is hard back then. Life is not easy. You didn't have proper modern healthcare. If you broke a bone, it could be life-ending or whatever.
Say a toothache or something.
Yeah, right? Anything. You could anything. So in simple infection.
Infant mortality rate as well.
Yeah. The average lifespan of people, people would typically live to about, in southern areas, like 40, 45 years old, but up north, and I think it would be mostly hardship and diet, it'd be 35 years old, 38
years old. We'd be gone by now.
Yeah, we'd be gone longer. Right? Yeah. Even back in the day, 1800s, like it, not too many people lived past 50, right? That's a rare incident, right?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to take into account his trip, and I think it's fascinating that he took the time to do this study and to
measure the results. Like
measure the results. Give a little bit of feedback, but it gives you kind of a insight. Because it's not like there's any written history, written word of the Inuit back in the day, right? It's all word and oral history and history by songs and stuff like that. So there's not a lot of detail that are going to be
generation. It'd be like we were hunting the walrus, we were hunting
exactly.
The whales, the
it's
seals.
High points only, right?
Yeah. It's not like, well, here's what I had for dinner. They're not journaling like we do nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah.
Day one.
Yeah, exactly.
Day 47. Yeah. Here's what I had for lunch, breakfast, dinner, snack.
So it's interesting to see what his trip did. Like when we talked to West about his journeys and his trips, he always described how he bulked up, and also from the show alone, we also learned a lot of the contestants would bulk up. It's like I'm going
Frank Wolf still him as well.
They it's like I'm going to lose weight. This is hard work. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be burning more calories than I'm consuming. So you'd bulk up because to compensate for this weight loss, and so it's interesting to see that he did lose weight, but it wasn't an unhealthy loss.
No.
He was surprised, and so was the doctor surprised. Like now, long term, if you were talking decades, because.
Yeah, I think that would be. Well, there would come a point where you just can't sustain.
I came across some notes about in northern Canada, they found two women. One was, they estimated, they're 500 years old. They were frozen in ice in a cave, and one was about 20, one was about 40. And they said both of them had massive bone loss, osteoporosis, hardening of the arteries. So the hardening arteries be from a high fat diet. The bone loss would be like you, there wouldn't be a lot of calcium intake, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're talking high fat, high protein diets, no starches, no carbohydrates. So there's going to be bone loss. So there's a lot of osteoporosis would be prone to it in the people back then. But this was interesting. Like when you think about this long journey, this kayak trip, and the results he got from his testing. I just found it fascinating. Like, we're kind of wavering off of the paddling theme here.
No, but it was part of it.
It's very interesting. It's very interesting that he did this study. And so, what was it? He's doing further, right?
So, yeah. So, this is what I said that you would get the science-y bit from this. That would be into you there. His next expedition will be taking place soon when he heads off to live with the Quechua and Huarani tribes along the banks of the Napo River in Ecuador to see how their hunter-gatherer diet will affect his body. Now, down there, you're going to have more vegetation.
There's more vegetation.
And you're going to have different types of meat, though.
Yes.
Like you're going to get monkeys and fish and and stuff like that, right? They eat parrots.
I have no idea.
There's got to be other birds and fowl down there.
Hmm.
Anyway, just one of those things. One of those little, hey, wait a minute.
A guy at work, he just came back. His Christmas vacation was in Peru. They did Machu Picchu and all that.
Yeah.
But there's a couple areas. It's quite localized. But guinea pig, very popular food.
Guinea pig?
It's
with the sign of hamster?
If you Google it, it shows spatchcock, guinea pig, and it's like all the heads are
Well, that's where they all came from, right?
Yeah. So guinea pig, alpaca. He said he did try alpaca as well. And so it's like, hey, it's local
I think
diet,
you can get that
right?
up here, can't you?
I'm
well,
sure
Well, I know the wool
you
anyway.
Can. Yeah, yeah, alpaca wool. I've never heard of it in, well, you the know, meat? In the southern states, you can buy squirrel in the grocery stores.
Wow. Ah. Figure we'd get that up here soon. So he's going to go down there and figure out how that will affect his body. I got to think he'd have a healthier lifestyle there than the Greenland diet.
Yes. Yes. Well, there. So in some of the research just in the last couple hours that we've been doing is one of the common problems up north was lack of calcium, so osteoporosis, bone loss, parasites.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is what he's going to have to deal with in Ecuador is he's going to have to be careful with parasitic infections and so on because...
Bugs, leeches.
Yeah, like up north, it's going to be worms and stuff from like this any salmon fish or whatever fish he's catching. And in Ecuador, it's going to be who knows what.
I've turned people off of fishing. Of eating fish because there was in August when the water gets really warm, you don't eat the bass because they develop the worms.
Oh, yes.
And somebody caught one, cleaned it, and I'm like, do I eat that? Why? And I started pushing out the worms from the meat, and they're just like, they've not touched bass again.
But no, you can eat it. It's fine. The worms are fine, but you have to cook it.
Yeah, well, I didn't trust them. Cook it properly. And I'm showing them. I always, if I'm going to cook that meat, like if I catch it and clean it, I'm going to eat it, but I'm making sure those worms are out.
I just make sure it's cooked really well. I just make sure it's cooked.
Well, it's not hard to pick out.
And this is something too, like this word to the wise is if you're going to go camping and catch some fish, say get yourself a nice salmon, don't do a sushi day. Because you're going to get parasitic worms. You have to either freeze salmon.
Well, who's carrying in the rice?
Sashimi.
Sushi's off the table without the rice and seaweed.
Who brought the seaweed and the rice? But you know what I mean.
You will get
parasitic worms, and you'll have to get treated for it. So with typical...
How do you know this, Derek?
Because I saw there was a group of kids who went fishing.
Named Derek.
They record. No, it wasn't me. But anyways, they said, don't do this. And so they showed some of the videos. They showed them enjoying their salmon sushi. And then they had videos of them all in the emergency room getting treated for parasitic worms.
Yeah, raw fish just...
Yeah. So
you one thing to get it from a sushi bar, but not out in the wild.
Exactly. So with with fish and pork and whatever, you either have to freeze it for 30 days or cook it well to kill the parasites, especially with pork, especially with salmon and
other fish.
And
that's why I bring a freezer with me on every canoe trip.
Well, that's why you cook it. Don't do sushi in the wild because there are parasitic worms in the meat. You can't help it. It's going to be there, guaranteed.
Yeah.
Right.
For those who don't have Arctic food in the freezer, it's still possible to connect with the spirit of his mission. Mike's advice is to choose food that is as close as possible to its natural state. Most of our food has changed so much and been selectively modified, so it doesn't reflect what we are eating a few thousand years ago. Back in Suffolk, however, he still has a taste for the Arctic. I barely eat carbs now, and my freezer is full of Greenlandic food. It's full of seal and matak, and I occasionally break out a couple bags of capelin as well.
So where does he acquire this? Oh, I guess he does work.
He's a chef. He's got contact.
Yeah, he's got contact.
Hey, I know a guy.
And he works in Greenland, so I guess.
To find out more about Mike's Eat Your Environment mission, check out eatyourenvironment.com. Pretty neat site. Go check that out if you want to find out more about what he's getting into and
it's pretty
give you some ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But that, yeah, that's pretty neat.
It is. So it makes you think. It's like, just hearkening back to some of the episodes of Alone that we saw, I imagine anybody who's done Alone and had been up north and it's like, well, you know what? This is, I'm going to have to eat the fish raw or this, that, the other thing. It's like, and the producers of the show are going to say, okay, on your return, you're going to have to take some medication to fix up whatever parasites you've acquired.
Right?
Parasites are protein.
Yeah,
but they have to be cooked. Otherwise, they're just going to eat you. Why am I losing so much weight?
Right?
It's the parasite diet.
It's Timothy the tapeworm! And Peter the parasite!
Yeah.
They're going to town, having a party in your intestines.
We just did a whole body scan on you, and you have a parasite. Oh, that's Timothy.
That's Timothy. Is Petey still in
it's
there?
Okay. Yeah, it's okay.
Peter and Timothy.
There was two of them.
Yeah. Somebody got evicted.
Timothy's 8 feet long.
Last thing here. We're going to go over the upcoming spring outdoor shows again, just to keep them in people's minds.
Yes.
The one coming up in a couple weeks, January 25th. That's not that far away, really.
No, I can't believe it's already 2025.
Right?
This is our second episode of the year, and it's just like, goodness me.
Our second? Yes.
We published on the 2nd of
January. I was just thinking there was a 3rd or something.
Oh, no.
Time flies, dude, when you're having fun.
Yeah.
Hamilton, Ontario, the Hamilton Adventure Expo, the Ancaster Fairgrounds, January 25th. Tickets, $15 in advance, online. Last I think I saw was 80% online advance tickets sold out.
Oh, yeah? Yes.
$20 at the door. Yeah. For more information, HamiltonAdventureExpo.com.
And this is a first running of this event.
Right. First running of it.
It's the new one. It's down in the Golden Horseshoe. We mentioned it last episode. So this is a new thing. So it should be interesting. I've gone through the speaker list and the presenters list and stuff like that. There's a lot of people that are going to be interesting to see. So I think this will be, for the first off, it looks like it's going to be pretty exciting, pretty fun.
Yeah. Toronto Outdoor Adventure Show, Toronto, Ontario International Center, February 21st to 23rd. Tickets are $17 plus tax, or a weekend pass for $20 plus tax.
That's a pretty good deal. It'd be good for you because you typically go 2 or 3 days.
Well, usually I'm also speaking, so I get a lanyard.
Yes, so you have to go.
So it'd be a great one for you.
But I'm saying for people who do that type of thing, if they're going to
make it for a couple of days.
Yeah, a couple days. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, get the weekend pass. Outdooradventureshow.ca. Now, there is one like in Calgary, and I think there's one in Montreal. There's another one out that way somewhere.
Yeah.
But yeah, just make sure you're checking out the Toronto one. Quiet Adventure Symposium in Lansing, East Lansing, Michigan,
yeah,
at the MSU Pavilion, March 1st. We will be there again, recording live and in person.
Yes.
Tickets are $13 in advance or $20 at the door. That's a $7 savings. I can get you a couple of coffees and a donut. For more information, quietadventures.org. This is one of my favorite shows because it's not just paddling. It's a lot of different things. All people motivated? Not motivated. What's the word I'm looking for? It takes people to do it. So hiking, biking, paddling.
Yeah. Highly motivated people. That's what they say. All those people on Mount Everest that have passed away.
They were highly motivated.
Yeah. Stay lazy, my friends.
Yeah. You know what food doesn't get recalled? Donuts. Donuts don't get recalled.
Donuts and whiskey. And speaking of Quiet Adventure Symposium, we should actually mention the rabbit show at the same time.
Oh, the rabbit show next door.
Yes, we'll have to get the link for that.
I will not be bothered or bugged to be bringing home a rabbit, because the one that usually harasses me about bringing home a rabbit is not here.
But it's like $5 a pound.
Right? Come on, Dad. Bring home a giant Flemish.
Oh, that would be neat, eh?
Oh, I don't know what my dog would do.
I don't know if you could actually get it across the border.
Well, you'd have to have papers.
You'd have to prearrange.
Yeah. You'd have to have, like, vet papers and... Because, like, when I take our dogs across, like, we used to take Hunter across
the border. You have to have papers.
I'd always brought my rabies
papers. We need your papers.
I brought her rabies papers. Yep. They never asked to see mine.
Because they will block you from entering with the animal.
Yep. Even just the collar thing, I think, you still need the papers.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. They need a vet check to show, to give it evidence, free of rabies or other diseases and parasites and so on.
Yeah, I just visited my vet and say, I'm crossing the border. Can I get papers? And print off, and there you go. Out the door I went. Canucopia, Madison, Wisconsin, Alliant Energy Center, March 7th to 9th. That's, like, the biggie.
Yeah, I've never been to it.
You got to go one day, dude.
Eventually.
Maybe next year. We are going to go this year, but then things happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah. As much as I love the people in Wisconsin, I'm going to Japan.
Priorities.
I love you, people, but see ya. Bye-bye, Felicia. ticket $16 per day or $32 for a weekend pass. That's three days, right? Rutabaga.com for more information. And the Ottawa Outdoor and Adventure Travel Show, Nepean, Ontario, Nepean Sportsplex, April 26th to 27th. Free admission, free parking. AdventureOttawa.ca for more info. This is a good show to go to. Unfortunately, it was stopped for a number of years, and there was another one as well, and they've combined a couple of them. So it really hasn't taken off again like it had.
They have struggled.
Yeah. So hopefully it's going to come back. And with all the people, and I'm sure we've talked about this before, with all the people in the Ottawa area that go
it's a large population.
Hiking in Gannara and the Gatineaus and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly, right.
And you figure in the Rideau Canal and everything.
So close to a golf
is everything
park.
Right there.
Yeah.
Like, I'm surprised as many that it's not just busting with people.
And plus all the people that it's so close to Quebec and with Hull right across the border there, you'd think it'd be a no-brainer that it would be very, very popular.
They've talked about moving one, I think, is either moving this one or starting a new one up near Petawawa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I haven't heard about that one. There is one, these are the ones in our area here that we always typically go to. Yep. So we'll be at... probably all these except Canucopia. There's that one in Germany. I would love to check that one out some point.
I think they'll sponsor us to go over.
Right?
Airfare, accommodations.
That'd be awesome.
It would be awesome.
I will, you know what? If they're going to give me airfare and accommodations, I'll buy my own food. I'll go out on a limb and say I will buy my own food.
I'm in.
Don't you have relatives over in Germany?
I do have relatives, yeah.
And
they always come over to visit us here.
Well,
so I could go visit them there.
See? Hey, remember when you came to visit us? Yeah. Well, guess what?
I'm coming there.
Turnabout's fair play, Pally.
Yeah.
Now, that's supposed to be a big one over in Europe there, is the one in Germany. Yeah. So, and I think it's near the western border, too, so.
Yeah, I don't know. I have no clue where it is.
That's another one for the list. I think the guy from Algonquin Outfitters went over a few years back, before COVID. So, yeah. Anyway. And that's all I've got this week. You got anything else?
There was the one thing I wanted to mention just quickly.
Yep.
We talked briefly about the...
No, we didn't.
Yes, we did. So, I just found it interesting. It's when we talk about, when we were talking about lifespans, Inuit, and so on, it reminded me of it. And so, over the last, about 2 weeks ago, so over on Christmas Day, actually, there was a matriarch wolf in the Yellowstone Park that two of the wolf packs had tangled over an elk. And so she had passed, and she was like 11 plus years old, which is amazing because wolves and wild typically have a lifespan of about 2 to 5 years. Anyway, so she had at least 10 litters. And so it was fascinating to read about this wolf's life and them talking about it. And it kind of, gave the opportunity for an educational moment. Because a lot of people are up in arms, and there's a lot of opinions about it. But when they returned wolves, they took a bunch of wolves from Canada and brought them down south of the border.
Oh, yeah, they put them in Yellowstone.
Yellowstone, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so what I found interesting is they did studies since they've done that, and they found without the wolf packs, the populations of beaver and deer and so on just exploded. And so a lot of the fauna along the edge of creeks and rivers were just eaten down in the winter, especially because that's all they could really get it to. And so the river edges were not solid and firm. So the rivers would change course a lot. And as well, there was a weird population growth and collapses of of different wildlife like beaver and muskrat and deer and so on, right? And they found that after wolves were reintroduced, that it balanced out the ecology of the areas. The rivers and streams stopped moving. There's a lot of regrowth of a lot of these shoreside trees because the deers were being predated on, and so the wolves were living healthy, and a lot of the populations were kind of balanced out. So I found that interesting. It was sad that this matriarch of the she was the leader of that wolf pack,
mm-hmm.
And so it was interesting that she had such a long lifespan. She lived, lost an eye about 5 or 6 years ago, so she was one-eyed, but still a very strong and healthy matriarch of the pack. So it was an opportunity for me to remind me of the positives of reintroducing wolves into some of these park areas. Like a lot of farmers are like, hey, they're eating my sheep or eating my cows and whatever. But, you know, I think it's a limited amount that they do. And but for the most part, I think it's it does balance out various populations.
Mm-hmm. It was May, her 10th litter this past May.
Yeah,
which they say is most likely a park record. 11 years old, lifespan usually 2 to 5.
Yeah,
yeah. I remember there was a lot, especially the cattle farmers and stuff, sheep farmers outside the park were getting all in uproar, and they wanted to start shooting. Yeah.
And I can get that. I understand that. Like, if you lose even one sheep or if you lose a couple chickens or whatever, it's not a good thing, right? Because mm-hmm. that's your livelihood. But if you can
think... But they were paying.
So, yes.
They were paying the ranchers for anything that was lost due to the wolves.
Yes. So you get paid for your mm-hmm. losses. And so, but it is... I think what the important thing is it does help the environment. It balances out all the different populations. People goes, well, no, I balance the deer population because I hunt. Well, you know what? In the parks, you can't. And
right.
And so it does help out in the parks. And most of these wolf packs their territories were within the park. So I just find it interesting that it did balance. And again, everybody's going to have a different opinion. This is my opinion.
Yep.
And the studies kind of work out to show that it does help balance the ecology.
But they did all that wolf studies here for decades.
Yeah.
In Algonquin Park and found the same thing.
Yep.
You take the wolves away and the ecosystem, I mean, and not just the wolves, you take something out of that environment and there's problems.
Well, there was over the last, I think the last time I read up on it, they're saying that over the last 50 plus years, like there's, without the wolves, a large population of wolves, they found that in modern times, you would have a large moose population. And then, and the deer population would collapse, and then the deer would move back in, and so brain worms were, the deer could handle them, and the, so the deer would drop eggs, the moose would pick up the worms, and the moose would get the brain worms, and that population would collapse, and the deer population would blow up again. So it was this seesaw thing, but they said back in the day, they were always perfectly balanced because the wolves predated on the weakest of the herds, right? So the deer population was balanced, the moose population was balanced, and whatever other things that the wolves preyed on were balanced.
Yeah.
And so there is some evidence there that there is a balance.
Yeah. 907F.
Yes.
Queen of the Wolves.
Yes.
Was the leader of the Junction Butte Pack.
Yeah, and it's funny, but it's just because we study tag and track animals, so she's got a numbered name, right?
Yeah.
So.
And this is in Yellowstone.
Yes.
But yeah, I remember them making a big deal of shipping the wolves down from Canada to Yellowstone.
It was like 70s or 80s or something, wasn't it?
Is it the 80s?
I can't remember when
it was. I thought it was the 90s.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't the 2000s. It was either the 90s or late 80s.
Yeah.
But I seem to remember the 90s.
Yeah.
But
I remember it was a big thing because a lot of the farmers were up in arms. They're like, no, you can't redo this. They're going to eat my sheep. Well, we'll pay you for the sheep.
And they did.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's still, there's getting too many now, so we got to start shooting them.
Yeah. Well, what else? So do we, when it comes to too many people, do we start hunting people?
No, we're not allowed to, apparently. I know. That's the Purge. There's a movie about that.
Anyway, that was my contribution because I sent you that story.
I totally forgot about that. I thought
it was interesting. So I thought I'd want to mention it's not necessarily paddling, but it is outdoorsy.
Yeah, we talk about the Bear Week, so you know, it's all good. It's all good. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I think that's all I've got this week.
I think we're good. I said my bit.
Alrighty. Well, look at that. It's almost an hour and 15 minutes we've been yabbering. I'm sure we can come out for another couple
hours.
I talked too much today.
Yeah,
shut up, Derek. Go back to reading.
I know. I'm going to go back to sleep now.
Why not? You drank all my beer.
Hey, this is the first time in months that I didn't supply the beer.
No, it's not. You lie.
You supplied beer?
The last batch before yours.
Yes, you did.
Right?
It was like 2 weeks in a row.
Right?
So it's like we're going on.
It was more than 2 weeks in a row. I bought eight. It was 4 weeks in a row. So that would have been all of November.
And that's because Monty's is not open.
I was told about Sir Monty's.
Yeah.
I was Christmas shopping at Sage.
Yeah.
One of those essential oil places.
Candle store.
And now I find out how much my wife is spending on these essential oils. Good God!
Wait a sec.
I'm buying four new canoes! Because that stuff's expensive. Yeah. Anyway, I was talking about one of the, they were like cabin smells and forest smells. I said, I just take my canoe out into the... out in the rivers and lakes and smell the forest.
Yeah.
And the girl said, oh, my dad's big into the canoeing. And we got in discussion and told her about this and whatnot. But it's like,
How did Monty's come into that conversation?
So she's the one that said, my dad goes to this Monty's place.
Yeah.
And Sir Monty's.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, so then I told you about it. And go, oh, that's the old strip club. How do you know, Derek?
It stood out. It had a man on a horse in front of it.
Right. Yeah.
I know nothing.
I know nothing about nothing except it's a beer place now. Yeah. I I was told.
I was told.
By a good information from a good source.
Yeah. Yeah. I tried to go back in Google Street View, and Google Street View was not old enough to catch the old, what was it called? I can't remember.
According to your email, Tanglewood.
Tanglewood. Yeah. Tanglewood, yes. Tavern.
Yeah.
So Tanglewood Tavern, but the Google Street View is not old enough to cover that.
Tanglewood Tavern. Yeah. Home of the Bowmanville Rippers.
No, not Bowmanville. It was Curtis.
Oh, you're in Bowmanville. Curtis is like down the street.
Yeah.
It's like the south of the 401.
It's a good 20 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. They were ne'er-do-wells over there.
Anyway.
Where were you tonight? Not in Curtis.
I want to stop talking because I do not look good in this conversation.
Oh, Derek of the Rippers. Anyway, if you want to find out more about us, go to DerekGoesToTheStrippers.com. You can find us at PaddlingAdventuresRadio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. You can download or stream our episodes at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Podbean, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can just go to the episode page at PaddlingAdventuresRadio.com, and you can stream or download all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.